there were people like you who were doing it in a different way. But I would say the majority of the providers at that time, it was much more of a dry clinical experience. It was just about, hey, while I'm here getting my mole check, can you throw some Botox units in my forehead? You know, it was just very, you know, clinical, right? Yeah. And yet Botox had a 98% patient satisfaction rate. So people were lined up around the block. They didn't much care about the experience. They just wanted a smooth forehead, right? Mm-hmm. And so I thought to myself, even back then, like, how interesting. What if we made this a great experience? What if we actually made it something that people looked forward to and that felt good and that, you know, was rooted in actually enhancing confidence, not telling everybody what's wrong with them and how they needed to be fixed, right? Or if they were broken and they needed to be put back together.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Technology of Beauty, where I have the opportunity to interview the movers and shakers of the beauty business, and today is no exception. Today, in our beautiful studio here in Manhattan Beach, we have Nikki Levy, who is the founder and the CEO of Alchemy 43.
Hi, nice to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you, Nikki. So, Nikki, before we get into Alchemy 43, tell us a little bit about yourself. Where did you grow up?
Sure. I'm originally South African, so I was born in South Africa. My family immigrated when I was a baby, and I grew up in Orange County, California, and went to UC Davis for college in Northern California and have been in Los Angeles ever since.
Now, before we go there, that was a lot, and it was pretty fast. I'm going to go back.
Okay.
So what city of South Africa were you born in?
Johannesburg.
Okay, I'm supposed to be there this August.
Oh, nice.
And then your family moved to Orange County, specifically what city?
Irvine.
Okay, and what year was that?
Well, we came to the States actually earlier. We lived in Houston for a year.
I see.
And then ended up in Orange County. I think we got to Orange County in 1981.
Okay, did you go to high school there?
I did.
What high school did you go to?
Woodbridge High.
Uh-huh. I went to Catella High. My parents went to Anaheim High. My grandparents and great-grandparents were in Anaheim.
Wow, I didn't know.
My family's been there a long time. That's where I wanted to know. My 91-year-old mother lives in Newport Beach.
Still. Oh, amazing.
Yeah, she was born in Hogue Hospital in Orange. You've heard
Same
of that?
Same with my sister,
so she's 91. She was born there. I was born there, and my nephews and nieces were born there.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Very cool.
So we have a lot of roots in Orange County. Mm-hmm. So then you went to UC Davis. Were you going to be a veterinarian or something?
No, I always...
or wine?
I know. It's kind of funny that I landed up there, and funnily more that I chose between Davis and USC. Those were my two like top choices.
Uh-huh.
And I was interested in like communications, PR, journalism. Like I had all these different ideas in that world. And Davis is obviously not known for that. But I had a couple of really good friends that were 1 year above me.
Uh-huh.
And between that and the cost of going between the two schools, I decided on UC Davis. And it was kind of a great experience because I was sort of a big fish in a small pond in terms of my major and my area of focus and study. So I think probably I would have been one of many at USC. And at Davis, I was like one of few.
Yeah, it's a great school.
It was great.
I know a number of people that went to UC Davis.
Yeah.
Okay, so when you finished at Davis, what was your first job?
So I actually started working part-time at a cosmetics counter at Macy's in Sacramento while I was in college, and never thought it could be a real job because it was too fun. And I graduated. So I did a bunch of work all throughout college in cosmetics, and I studied abroad in London while I was in college. And the company I had been working for said to me, hey, we love you. Do you want to work in London for the summer? You're going to be there anyway. And I was like, sure. What a great experience. So, you know, at 19 or 20, I worked at Harrods and Selfridges in London at the makeup counter. And so that was really kind of like my first foray into aesthetics, the way I see it, and the feeling that you get when you, and I know you can relate to this, when you give somebody the ability to look in the mirror and like what they see.
Uh-huh.
And I think I became addicted like right away to that, to being able to impact people's lives in that way. And to some degree, that's what I've chased my entire career. And so that's really where it started for me. So after college, you know, I was working in cosmetics. I had, you know, a bunch of ideas as to what I wanted to do with my degree, but no other work experience. And so what I did was I got an assistant counter manager job at Nordstrom for a cosmetics company, MAC Cosmetics.
Right.
And I did a bunch of internships. So I worked at an entertainment publicity firm. I worked in ad sales, an ad sales department for like a Hollywood publication called The Hollywood Reporter.
Yes.
And I tried out a bunch of things, and I literally hated everything else except for what I was doing. Uh-huh. And eventually I stopped fighting it, and I was like, actually, this can be a real job. And I started getting, you know, opportunities presented to me and promotions. And so eventually I realized you can make a career out of beauty.
And cosmetics.
And cosmetics. So that was the start of it for me.
So, okay, but before Alchemy 43, there had to be some other steps.
There were some other steps,
so take us through them. I'm curious.
Yeah. So basically all through my early 20s, I worked in cosmetics.
Selling cosmetics?
Starting there. So started at a counter, then I got, sort of elevated into management, counter manager and then manager. And so did that mostly for Nordstrom.
Okay.
And then Nordstrom came to me at some point and said, listen, we have a really successful personal shopper program here for apparel. Mm-hmm. We really want to pilot this idea of having a personal shopper for beauty, and we think you're it. And so we're going to give you a studio in our store, and we're going to get you trained by all of the brands. So you're going to be a brand expert on all of the products. And so people can have private consultations with you, and you can pick and choose the best products for people, from all the brands, as opposed to working for one. And so they said, and by the way, if you do well with this, we're going to launch this all over the country. So kind of like you're the beta.
Did you also get an esthetician license or a makeup artist license?
No.
Or any formal training along those lines?
No. In those days, you learned by doing. Certainly, probably going to like makeup artistry school would have been helpful. But I really, for the first year after college, I worked at a retail MAC cosmetics store, which in those days was like artist central. It was like where all the artists, and that's real. I mean, I literally spent a year painting faces. And so I really feel like that was my schooling for makeup artistry.
Sure.
And I learned, everything I needed to know and more about the sort of facial artistry piece of it. And so so I did that job for Nordstrom, and, because of a variety of things, namely being the main person who wanted to do this was the VP DMM of cosmetics at the time. She retired, and they brought somebody in her place who came from Nordstrom Rack and didn't really understand kind of the concept with what we were building, and was kind of like, I just need to focus on the cosmetics business and learn that. So they said to me, is there anything else you want to do for us? Do you want to be a buyer? Do you want to do you want to manage a store? What do you want to do? And I was like, nope, I'm ready to move on to the next thing. And I had it in my head that I wanted to go to Australia and work in Australia. So I lined up a job for myself with the Sephora of Australia called Mecca Cosmetica at the time. They were like the Sephora of Australia. And I got a student work visa because I was still under 27, and I lined up a job and I had my plane tickets, and I got a call one day from someone I didn't know who knew me through the industry. And she said, hey, I have an amazing opportunity to talk to you about. Can you meet me at the international terminal at LAX airport? I want to interview you, and can you meet me there? Of all places. And so I already knew
heading out to Australia.
10 days later, I had a plane ticket. I was about to go. But I, of course, was curious. So I took the meeting. And by the end of the meeting, I was like, okay, I'm not going to Australia anymore. And that was an opportunity that was a really amazing opportunity at the time where Calvin Klein. So there was a very successful mass market cosmetic producer named Eric Chen. He had a company called Marquins International. He was a Chinese businessman, and he had made his fortune in like the 99 cent cosmetic brands that you buy at like CVS. He wanted to get into prestige cosmetics, and so he licensed the Calvin Klein name from CK, and he hired myself and two veterans from the Lauder Corporation to basically build the brand from scratch. So at 20 something, I had a chance to literally create a brand out of nothing. I did everything from naming the eyeshadows to writing the training and education program for the brand to meeting with retailers and flying to Calvin Klein corporate offices in New York every month to get approvals because they had to approve everything that we put out. And so that was just a really, I think, important entrepreneurial moment for me because it solidify, like, I'm definitely going to have my own company one day. Like, this is in my blood. And so that was kind of that moment for me. And then basically after a couple of years, he decided, that all the premium costs of launching a luxury beauty brand were not for him. And so he decided not to renew the license. And from there, I'm trying to think what happened next. I guess from there, I was freelancing. So I had a bunch of production work going on. I had a thriving wedding business doing makeup for weddings. That was a really fun time in my life. And my favorite thing about doing makeup for weddings was I loved hearing people's stories of how they met their partners. And I dreamed one day of writing a book, and each chapter of the book would be like the name of the two people and their story, because I just thought nothing was cooler than hearing everyone's individual stories of how they connected with their partners. So maybe that will still happen. I have not written that book yet. And I mean, you know, from there, I guess the most important thing that happened as it pertains to this conversation is Allergan, the company that manufactures Botox, was launching a product called Latisse that grows your eyelashes. And they were, I learned through a friend of mine who had been recruited by them, that they were looking for people with a cosmetic background to represent the company because they believed Latisse had a merchandising component in medical offices. And they thought, who better to help us with that than cosmetic industry people? Mm-hmm. Typically, those business development roles were held by people that had, you know, really been in the pharmaceutical sales business, sure. Which I had not. But nonetheless, Allergan recruited myself and a couple of my colleagues from the beauty industry to come in. And so in April of 2009, I became the Beverly Hills 90210 Botox BDM. And so that was kind of my first foray into medical aesthetics. And It was eye-opening, to say the least. It was, I really viewed it as an extension of my beauty industry expertise. I mean, mm-hmm. The intention of the consumer is exactly the same. You're doing these things to look and feel your best. The products I represented were Botox, Juvederm, and Latisse, so all, you know, technically non-invasive aesthetic, you know, cosmetic products. And I remember my pitch to the doctors when I would go into their offices and meet them was, I come from the beauty industry where a woman walks into Bloomingdale's, right? And there's 20 makeup counters right next to each other. All the products look lovely. All the price points are similar. How does the consumer decide which counter she's going to walk up to? Mm-hmm. Similarly, right here in Beverly Hills, there's 20 plastic surgery offices right next to each other. All the doctors are highly credible. Price points are similar. How does the consumer? So I drew this similarity, uh-huh. This parallel between the two industries. And that was literally my first week of work. And by the end of that week, I don't think I ever did that again. Because I realized after doing the job that the only thing that was similar about the industry and the experience was the consumer's intent. In my mind, it was very different, right? And you know, there were people like you who were doing it in a different way. But I would say the majority of the providers at that time, it was much more of a dry clinical experience. It was just about, hey, while I'm here getting my mole check, can you throw some Botox units in my forehead? You know, it was just very, you know, clinical, right? Yeah. And yet Botox had a 98% patient satisfaction rate. So people were lined up around the block. They didn't much care about the experience. They just wanted a smooth forehead, right? Mm-hmm. And so I thought to myself, even back then, like, how interesting. What if we made this a great experience? What if we actually made it something that people looked forward to and that felt good and that, you know, was rooted in actually enhancing confidence, not telling everybody what's wrong with them and how they needed to be fixed, right? Or if they were broken and they needed to be uh-huh. put back together, right?
Right.
And so that was kind of where the idea stirred for me. And then in 2010, I'm sure you're aware of the concept dry bar. Mm-hmm. I thought it was fascinating how they took something that was part of a larger hairstyling experience where, you know, you would go and get your hair cut and colored. At the end, they would blow dry it and you leave looking fabulous. And they extrapolated out just one aspect, just the blowout, and said, let's make a brand around the blowout. And I similarly thought, let's make a brand around the injectable. And so that was kind of my, I would say, like, my aha moment. And I think it was probably, for me, it was that, it was sort of that hybrid, the hybrid of my experience of being in the beauty industry where the consumer, it was all about the experience. Like how you sold cosmetics was you built a relationship with the client, you gained their trust, you connected with them on kind of an intimate level, because I've always believed that specifically when you're making changes to your face, it's very vulnerable. It's like your face is how the world sees you. Your face is how you're recognized. So whether you're wearing a red lipstick for the first time, getting Botox for the first time, or shaving your beard for the first time, it's like, it's vulnerable. It's a very like emotional kind of experience. And if you don't recognize that or realize that, you're probably not building that long-term trust with the patient. And so that was kind of my, I would say, like the thing that was driving me. And so I left Allergan in 2012 and I had this idea. I was really interested in pursuing it. But I also recognized after 3 years in the industry, I didn't know what it would be like to be a small guy. Like I'd only worked for a huge company with tons of resources. I didn't know if I could scale a business like this as a non-medical provider myself. I didn't know how I was going to get money to do this. I mean, I didn't know much, right? Except for that I had this vision for what I wanted to build. And so I went very, very, I would say intentionally, and worked with two startups in the business. So one guy was buying and renting out cosmetic laser machines. So basically, you know, for medical spas that were, you know, having to buy the latest and greatest technology, financing the equipment. And then by the time it was, you know, the equipment was paid off, there was something better and brighter. No one cared about the old one anymore. He was solving that by offering like rentals. which I think was a great idea. So I worked very closely with him and kind of really learned how to launch something in the space. And then I worked with another founder who had a oral skincare pill, and it was kind of like before the days of ingestibles. It was called Glycidin. I don't know if you ever heard of it, but basically it was a product that was from France, a really interesting mix of ingredients, and it was non-prescription, but he was intent on only selling it through medical offices. So because of my relationships, he wanted me to help him kind of launch it here in the US. Mm-hmm. So those were two very pivotal experiences for me, and that kind of gave me, I would say, the confidence and the chops to like say, hey, if they can do it, I can do it, right? Mm-hmm. And so then I was ready to go. I supported myself by independently repping a couple of medical devices just, you know, just while I was writing the business plan and working with a healthcare attorney. So I sold a microneedling machine and a PRP centrifuge and a couple other things. Uh-huh. And I had no idea how to write a business plan. I was like casually dating this guy who said, hey, have you heard of mybusinessplanbuilder.com? You can write your business plan on that. I was like, oh, sounds great. So I went on mybusinessplanbuilder.com and I plugged in my ideas and all my thoughts, and it generated all these cool looking charts. And I was like, okay, well, this seems like something. And then I really spent a year with a very prominent Los Angeles healthcare attorney, basically figuring out if I could build a business like this, how it would need to be set up, how I could scale it nationally. So could I operate a business like this in every state? And what would international look like? Like, does this really have the legs that I think it could have? And so once I had kind of enough conviction around that, and I had the company more or less structured, then I needed cash. And I don't, you know, I would say I don't have a rich uncle who wrote me a check. I didn't have anyone that could support me on this. And so I needed to raise money. I had no formal training that. I don't have an MBA or anything like that. And a friend of mine dragged me to a female entrepreneur like interview event one night in Santa Monica. She said, just come with me. I'm going to this, you know, event where this founder is going to be interviewed. And I thought, sure, I'll go with you. So it was the founder of NYX Cosmetics. Her name is Toni Ko. And I was completely fascinated by her story. She is also from an immigrant family. She's from Korea. She moved to America, I think, when she was 12 or 13. Didn't speak a word of English. She started her makeup brand at 21 years old. And she talked about how she was driving around LA in her Honda Civic, dropping off samples at beauty supplies of like lipsticks and cardboard boxes. And she sold her company to L'Oreal for $500 million in 2014. I still get goosebumps when I tell that story. Uh-huh. And she still was a majority owner at the time. So, you know, it was just a story of grit and hustle that I really related to. She felt like to me, while she was super glamorous and elegant, I could tell that this was a woman who would not, like, there's nothing she wouldn't do for her business. And uh-huh. she would have been just as comfortable, you know, unpacking a box in flip-flops as she was walking a red carpet. And I could really relate to that. And I thought her story was really amazing. She said at the end of her interview that she had signed a non-compete with L'Oreal, so she couldn't start anything new, and that she was doing some personal investing. And so my brother was in business school at NCIAD in France at the uh-huh. time. And I was talking with him on Skype the next day, and he said, well, you can email her on LinkedIn. And at that time, I didn't know you could reach out to people you didn't know on LinkedIn. I thought it was only for people you knew. And I was like, I can? He's like, sure. So I emailed her out of the blue and I just said, you don't know me. I attended this event you spoke at last night. I was really taken with your story and I have this business idea. You know, would you be willing to meet with me? And she agreed to meet me for breakfast at the SLS Hotel in Beverly Hills. And by the end of breakfast, she's like, I'm in. How much money do we need to get this started? And so she was my first investor. She invested, I think about, so I raised $720,000 to open my first location. I think she did about half of that. And then she brought in a couple of friends of hers that were local, you know, local sort of venture investors and angels. And we filled out the round. And then it was kind of off to the races from there. I could go on and on.
No. Tell me where to start. So where was your first store?
It was on Cannon Drive in Beverly Hills. So mm-hmm. I was laser focused on starting the brand in Beverly Hills. I believe that's where my heritage with the medical aesthetics industry was. I believed that was where the original consumer was. And I was, you know, I also thought for scalability reasons, like that heritage of Beverly Hills was so important. But it was also very important to me that we didn't launch in a medical building. I didn't want it to feel like a medical office. I wanted it to feel, I would say, more salon than spa, mm-hmm. but I wanted it to feel more accessible than a medical building. And so, as you probably know, the Golden Triangle, there's two or three streets that are pretty much dominated by medical offices. Mm-hmm. I was intent not to be on those. So it dramatically, you know, reduced my access. So I remember I was like working with all these real estate brokers to help me find a space, and no one was having any luck. They're like, there just isn't any availability on the streets you want. And so I got annoyed and frustrated. My investors were kind of like, what's happening? Let's go. And so I started pounding the pavement myself, and I literally walked into all of the hair salons and, I mean, probably a number of retail stores on Cannon and Beverly Drive, sure, and said, "Hey, do you want to move out? Are you interested in selling?" Literally, and I found someone who would. Oh, so my. there was a hairstylist who was, you know, in his 70s, and he was like, "You know what? Yeah, I'm kind of ready to move on." So I literally, I mean, it was kind of the best possible scenario. So I took over his lease, and it was like a 2.5 years left on the lease. Mm-hmm. So that was perfect as I was just getting started. Who knew what was going to happen? So I took over his lease. I had to pay him something called key money, which is like basically give him some money, yep, to, you know, and some stock in the company to go. And I took over his lease. I went to the city of Beverly Hills. I submitted all my plans. I built out my location, and I opened. A week after I opened, I was served with like cease and desist letter from the city of Beverly Hills. You can't operate a medical business in non-medical space. And I was like, yes, I can. You told me, you know, it's like, I told you exactly what I was doing. I submitted my plans. You guys signed off on everything. I had talked to my healthcare attorney ahead of time to say, hey, can I do this? And he had checked federal and state, but he didn't check city. And at that time, the city of Beverly Hills had a moratorium on medical businesses operating in retail space because what they said at the time was that they didn't want to have a reputation for being known for plastic surgery. Yes. So they wanted to not do that. I think it was also tax related. I think they could get more taxes from like a retail type business. So that ended up being like a 3-year battle. I don't say battle. It wasn't like an angry battle. It was just I had to hire zoning attorneys and, you know, deal. I got very involved in the city. I became friendly with the mayor and like all the city council people. I attended multiple city council meetings, and eventually I won. So eventually they said, okay, fine, you can operate here. And then I didn't stay. Then I didn't resign my lease after all that.
And you were primarily or exclusively doing injectables?
So at that time, it was pretty much exclusively Botox, HA fillers. Trying to think if in the early days.
Any energy based?
Nothing. No, we didn't have any devices. I think in the beginning, we literally just did Botox and fillers.
And who was, not by name, but yeah, was it a PA, NP, RN, or MD injecting?
So all physician extenders. So NPs, PAs, and RNs. My first couple hires were PAs.
And you had to have a supervising physician, right?
Yes, absolutely. And actually sort of several points of medical oversight. So yes, not only did I have to have a medical director who was supervising the clinical side of the, you know, business and overseeing our providers, we also had to have, we had to set up to do business in California, a medical corporation. So I can't own a medical corporation as a non-provider. So I own Spruce Holdings, Inc., which is our parent sort of management company, right? Management services company. And then we have multiple medical corporations under, you know, that sort of do business with Spruce Holdings. And those are owned by physicians that I, you know, have found.
Okay.
So And I think today, you know, I had to kind of set that up. Mm-hmm. I think today it's fairly standard the way that I think that's how most people do it that are not medical. Uh-huh. You know, that are not medical MDs. There's sort of like a more standard setup for kind of how you do it.
And that was your first store?
That was store one.
And you didn't renew that lease?
No, after two and a half years, yeah, we were kind of like, so by then we had opened 3 more locations in Los Angeles.
Ah, in the first 2.5 years?
Yeah. Yes. So I opened Beverly Hills in May of 2016, Cinco de Mayo 2016. And then 2018 was when I opened the 3 additional. So yeah, before that lease was up, I had opened 3 more. And those were in Los Angeles proper by the Farmers Market, mm-hmm, West Hollywood on Sunset Plaza, and Montana Avenue in Santa Monica.
Okay.
And so what was very interesting is when we opened those, we saw a ton of migration and like all of our Beverly Hills people went to these other locations. And when we started doing the sort of research on why, we realized that actually almost none of our customers lived in Beverly Hills. And they were commuting to us because they liked the brand and they liked the accessibility and all of that. But it really was not the Beverly Hills customer that was drawn to us. And that was kind of an aha moment for me. It's uh-huh. like, oh, this is actually not our customer. It's her niece. It's her son-in-law. You know, it's someone else. So that kind of was the first aha moment of like, we're actually bringing a new consumer in. Like we're bringing in people that actually haven't been going elsewhere for this and don't have a plastic surgeon on speed dial. So that was, so when it came time to renew that lease, we knew there was going to be sort of some cosmetic work we needed to do to the space. We would have to sign another 10 years. It was a very expensive lease. It was right next to La Scala on Cannon Drive.
Yeah, sure.
And, we basically said, let's for 2 months, try anyone who tries to book at Beverly Hills, let's see if we can move them to the other ones. And so we tested it and it worked, and it worked 100% of the time. And the next month after we closed Beverly Hills, all of our LA stores became profitable. So it was like, okay, that was the right decision. I'm still kind of sad about it to this day, because Beverly Hills just feels like my home, like where I started. And so I still like think that one day I'll open back up there and, you know, have a triumphant return.
Uh-huh. That's great. So, okay. So then tell me how about your growth? What other stores did you start with, say, the next year?
So, happy to talk about that, and can also share if you want about sort of the funding, you know, the funding story there. Cause I needed to raise money. You know, I basically had to raise money the entire time. Uh-huh. But basically, yeah. So from there, you know, we expanded heavily in the LA market, with those three locations in 2018. And you know, that was, I remember, a very sort of tumultuous time, because basically I went from having one store to adding three more within like a 3 month period. Mm-hmm. And it's just the way, as you probably know, with like build outs and these, you know, it's like all of that, all of the things related to building out spaces, you just kind of can't always control how it plays out in terms of when you open. And so it was not the intention to open three within 2 months. It was the intention to kind of stagger them, but that's just not how it played out. And so, I mean, we opened West Hollywood and Santa Monica within a week of each other. And it was just, I remember, just crazy. And the only thing, I didn't have children yet, I do now, but the only thing I could liken it to was like going from having a single child to having triplets, uh-huh, like overnight. And so it was just crazy times. But, you know, we're able to sort of hit our stride. And, you know, I added some leaders to the team and brought on some pros to help me, because, you know, up until that point, it was pretty much just me and, you know, my team of providers. Then we opened Flatiron in New York City, in April of 2019. So that was like, we went from, you know, LA based, LA proud, to like the other side of the country, where, by the way, I knew no one and had no real connections or any, you know, roots or anything. I'd never spent any real time in New York. But it was very important to me we were kind of touching both coasts. And what I didn't anticipate, which was really cool, was how much reciprocity we had in New York because of our brand in LA. People in New York knew about us. I think there's so many people that travel back and forth spend time on both coasts that people like knew we were there. They knew who we were. And since then, we've opened other new markets where that hasn't been the case, which is why I know that was kind of unusual. But yeah, so we were able to really kind of like make a go of it in New York. We opened in a very population dense part of town that was also both where people lived and where they worked. And I think a lot about real estate with this kind of company, right? And you think a lot about how wherever you are, you know, do you want to be where they live or where they work, right? And I think in LA, I have found it's better to be where they live. And maybe that's traffic related or public transport related, who knows? But in New York, I found that it's probably a hybrid of the two. It's kind of nice to be where they live and they work. And we got lucky with that first location, because it's kind of both. Mm-hmm. And so that was store number four, and then the pandemic. And we all were shut down. I'll never forget getting that call or seeing that news on March 17th. I think it was literally St. Patrick's Day on 2019. And we're like, okay, we have to close. And I remember thinking, I'm sure you were the same, it's like max 2 weeks. We'll be back open by April 1st, no question. I mean, 9 months later, we're like, oh my God, like, is what's happening? And I mean, that was obviously for everybody an incredibly scary time. It was like, okay, what are we going to do? I had a term sheet for a huge investor and a huge investment into my company. And that all went bye-bye immediately. Sure. And I had to go to my existing investors and ask for, you know, bridge money to get us through it. And we had to furlough all of our employees, and, you know, you just didn't know what was going to happen. I think the fortunate thing for us was that we sort of cocooned up and did all the right things early on. So we were able to survive it, which I'm very grateful for. I think a lot of people didn't. And, you know, we reopened as soon as we could. I remember, you know, it's interesting because I think back on that time and I think of how and I always say this about our industry. It's like at the end of the day, we all recognize that there's enough like patients out there for all of us. And there's just such a camaraderie and such a, I would say, a non-competitive spirit about the industry in such a cool way. And it's like, I mean, I was texting Lynn from Skin Spirit, like, hey, are you guys reopening? When does this happen? You know, we're all texting each other, like, what are we going to do? You know, how are you handling the PPP stuff? You know, it's just, it became this very collaborative time, which I think I'm very thankful for. Yeah. Yeah.
So how many stores do you have now?
So today we have 10 locations across, I would probably call it 4 or 5 markets in the U.S. So we're in Los Angeles, Newport Beach, Houston, Dallas, Plano, which is a suburb of Dallas, and then New York City. We have 2 locations now. So we're in Upper East Side and Flatiron.
And what's the average size of your stores?
About 1,200 to 1,500 square feet.
So pretty, and so pretty how small. Many injectors per store? Average.
2 to 3.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
And did you now, do you have any energy-based technologies?
We do microneedling and we do Clear and Brilliant. So I would say
that's
those.
That's a low-level laser.
Low-level, yeah. Correct, yeah. And
any cool sculpting?
Not yet, but it's definitely, you know, we have recently launched GLP-1s. And okay. So as I'm sure you know, the sort of launch of those and the high, you know, amount of interest and reception of that, I think kind of does open the door to more, you know,
body especially contouring.
More body contouring. Yep. Exactly. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Have you had any problems with medical boards or issues like that?
No. I mean, my viewpoint about that has always been, because I've been trying to do something big this whole time, I recognized that was going to come with scrutiny. So I was like, okay, let me make sure that I'm not the kid in the back of class getting away with stuff. I'm like the straight A student, you know, getting extra credit at the front of class.
Right.
Because obviously you just never want to attract the medical board. And, you know, once you're on their radar, you're on their radar. Uh-huh. And so I've done everything to make sure that wasn't the case. So I would say, you know, we operate, I would say, very conservatively. And we're just very careful and thoughtful about...
Sure.
You know, everything from areas of where we'll inject and where we won't to products we'll use and products we won't, et cetera.
Uh-huh.
So.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
So you've probably learned a ton.
I mean,
And you say you didn't go to business school. I think you did. You went to practical business school.
Exactly. School of Hard Knocks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So a couple questions. Tell me, like, first of all, what would your advice be to somebody who not necessarily wants to build Alchemy 43.
Yeah.
But what sort of advice do you have for young doctors or practitioners or providers based on your learning?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think I would say, you know, no matter how much planning and preparation you do, you will never have thought of everything. Like, you will never, ever have covered every single base. There will be absolutely unexpected things that happen to you that you never could have ever imagined for or ever planned for. And you kind of have to be okay with that. You have to kind of say, okay, I'm going to do as much planning as I can, and I'm going to leave room for the possibility that I will not have thought of everything, and things will come up that I wasn't prepared for, and kind of set your mind to that. To sort of being open to that. I think, you know, there's so many things, and I think in the first year or two, I think about this a lot, one thing could have happened in those first year or two that would have ended me, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I could have had one medical board visit, I was done. You know, there could have been one bad outcome, I was done. Now, you know, once you get kind of past that first few years, you sort of say, okay, it's not going to be one thing that's going to end me. I it would have to be a series of things. So let me make sure that I'm doing all the right things and being responsible, but also breathe a sigh of relief that it's like not going to be one thing. I mean, of course, I guess there's always, you know, there's probably something, you know, catastrophic that could happen that would, but ultimately, you know, it would, you probably will have enough sort of experience and support under your belt to like not let that thing happen. So I would just say it's a journey. You know, you won't have thought of everything. Do it anyway. Mm-hmm. I would say do it anyway. And you know, the rewards are like, it's the best thing I've ever done. I mean, I mean, you know, we talked earlier about my like career starting out, you know, graduating college. If you had told me this is what I'd be doing right now, I would have laughed you out of the room. Mm-hmm. I would have been like, what are you even talking about? What is Botox? Like, who cares? What do you even mean? I'm going to be a publicist, or I'm going to be this. And it's just crazy the path life puts you on and how you end up where you end up. I mean, I think when you're a doctor and, you know, you have a very clear path and you have to make those decisions early on, you know, it's a little different. It's like, for me, it's been a kind of a stumbling journey. And one of the things I say now is like, you know, for me, I kind of feel like in a lot of ways I found my way in the dark. Like, I stumbled around and stumbled onto things and, you know, opportunities came my way and I took them or didn't. Uh-huh. I'd love to be able to light the way for people and, you know, help them have more light on their journey and share, you know, some of the experience I've had to help them on their way. So that's kind of...
Do you counsel young entrepreneurs? Or?
I try to. I mean, I think, you know, there's... I'd love to be able to do more of it, you know, mm-hmm. as a CEO and founder and mom of a 2-year-old, single mom. I had a baby by myself 2 years ago. I'm stretched pretty thin, and you know, I find decisions you have to make about things you want to do and you know, how you want to spend your time versus what's real for you. But it's definitely something I hope to do a lot more of in the future. So I would say, yes, I do it a bit when I can. And I can't wait for the next phase of my career where I can do more.
You really should.
Yeah.
You really
Thank
should.
Thank you.
So can you tell me where Alchemy 43 came from?
Yes, absolutely. So I think I mentioned earlier that our corporate name is Spruce Holdings. So the initial name for the company was Spruce. And my thought about it was spruce up, like get yourself spruced up. I came up with a cute spelling, which was S-P-R-O-O-S-E.
Okay.
And the way I thought about the name, I remember I was so passionate about that name. And I thought about it like Google, where it's like, oh, I'm gonna Google it. I'm yes. like, oh, well, you can go and get spruced. I had this whole thing of how that was going to play out. So I filed the trademark for the name once I had my investors, and I got a denial from the trademark company, and they said, the trademark division, and they said, you can't call it Spruce because there's a dermatology concept in Northern California called Spruce Health, and it's consumer confusion. Even though it was spelled differently and it was nothing the same, it was, you can't call it that. So it was the 11th hour. I had already signed my lease. We were building out the website. I mean, it was like URLs were purchased, and now I have to come up with a new name. And I had like a pages and pages of every name you could think of, you know, just nothing was like sitting well with me. And I got home from dinner with friends one night, and I logged into Facebook, and someone had quoted the book, The Alchemist, you know, from the book. And I just, that word just kind of like, you know, lit something up in me. And so I typed into my Google browser, what is the definition of alchemy? And it was two things. It was a seemingly magical process of combination, creation, and transformation, and the study of chemistry that predated the periodic table that was concerned with changing base metals into gold. And I thought, that's it. I got like head to toe goosebumps. I was like, that's my name. We are Alchemy. And I remember I excitedly got on the phone and talked to one of my investors the next day and said, I thought of a new name. This is the name. And she was like, love it. Is there a number that's meaningful to you? Because she had seen a lot of like sort of market research on brands that have numbers associated having strong consumer recognition.
Okay.
And so I said, well, not really. Like 17 is my lucky number. I mean, you know, no. And she typed into her phone, how many muscles are in the face? And it was 43. So Alchemy 43 it was.
I'll be darned. What a great story.
Thank
love
you.
It. Yeah, that's fabulous.
Thank you.
Well, listen, as you look into your crystal ball, you've had a lot of experience up to now, but
yeah.
you have a lot still ahead of you.
Yeah.
What do you see in this industry in the next 3 to 5 years?
I mean, I think it's so exciting, the shape that it's taking, and just in general how there's such a more positive slant around this type of self-care and this type of sort of, you know, beauty, sort of pursuit of beauty. I think... you know, I started when Botox was still like something nobody talked about. It was very hush hush. It was, you know, do you have a back door I can sneak out of so no one sees me at La Scala? It was very private. And it's been really amazing to watch the evolution, I'm sure for you too, of how much it's changed and continues to change and continues to innovate and continues to, I think, celebrate providers in a new way. And, you know, I mean, I'm obviously not being a provider myself and having built my legacy brand and my brand around other people performing these services. You know, I'm humbled by the talent and I'm humbled by people that want to come work for my company and that want to train my company or be a medical director for my company. You know, because I truly believe there's such an artistry and talent to doing this well. And I have always found, you know, since I was a rep, that the people that have the best results time after time and the people that have those, you know, 3 month waiting lists of people trying to get in for an appointment are the people that truly love what they do and make clients feel great. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really what it's all about. So I think it's just been fun to continue to watch it grow and innovate and how much more, you know, see how much more acceptable and kind of celebrated it is to, you know, to just care for yourself in whatever way that means for you, whether it's getting a hair transplant, taking a yoga class, getting cool sculpting, you know, whatever that looks like.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, that's fabulous.
Thanks.
Anything else you want to share?
Yeah, well, we've got a lot of great plans and a lot of great, I think, great momentum in these markets that we've recently launched in and are planning to grow in. You know, really our goal is to be, you know, one of the number one brands in aesthetics. And that's a question I constantly ask myself and my team is how can we be the number one brand in aesthetics? And how can we continue to like, you know, get better and better? And so, you know, I think expect to see us in a neighborhood near you soon. as well, I think expect some products that I think are interesting, unique, and innovative in a way that the industry, I think, hasn't seen before. You know, in the same way that I feel like we've taken these treatments out of a very traditional environment and reframed them and repositioned them in kind of a new way. It's not like we're doing anything different than they've done, but we've just reframed these treatments like Botox and fillers and reframed the experience of getting them in some ways. We plan to do the same thing with some products that I'm really excited to be launching. So those are kind of the more immediate things, but
fantastic.
Thank you.
Well, it's very exciting and you're to thank be complimented. I'm very thank impressed. You. You've done thank a you. Wonderful job.
Thank you so much. Yeah, thanks for having welcome. Me today.
Thanks for coming.
Sure.
And thank you all for joining me for one more exciting episode of The Technology of Beauty, where I have the opportunity to interview the movers and shakers of the beauty business. And today was no exception. Thank you very much. We'll see you every Tuesday. Take care.